Next week is Rabbi Adler, and then I haven't built up the energy, so that's what I know is next week. So keep you informed.
Thank you so much, Howie. Thanks to all of you for coming out and being with me tonight, braving the relatively bad weather. It's much appreciated. So nostalgia is very much a double-edged sword. What do I mean? On the one hand, nostalgia can be a great source of inspiration, a source of relief from suffering. It could be a reconnection with the past. There's a reason why nostalgia generally evokes lovely images or lovely feelings in human beings. We're somehow built to respond to memories that we have of the distant past, and somehow we think of those days as better than, more idyllic, maybe a return to paradise, which perhaps has some deep theological resonances. So that's the upside of nostalgia, and I think we've all experienced, speaking for myself, I can indulge perhaps too much in nostalgia. And that's really the second side of the coin, or that's the other side of the dynamic, which can have perhaps a negative repercussion or a negative consequence. When we focus on nostalgia and the past instead of the present and the future, we can lose our connectedness to the here and now. We can lose our sense of what really is the mission of the moment, what we need to do now to engage the world around us, the people that we love. And I think that's the potential danger, perhaps even the fatal flaw of nostalgia, or at least of indulging nostalgia too much. So I want to set the stage for our learning tonight by indulging in a little bit of nostalgia. I think it's creative and constructive nostalgia. You guys can tell me what you think. But one of the first songs that I can remember on the radio was a song by a group that had some fleeting fame in the 70s. It was a group called Supertramp. And they had a few songs that kind of found their way into my little record deck or my record shelf. And one of the songs, and this song came out in 1979. My friend Chaim was right on the money, and on matters musical and sports, he is almost always on the money. This song came out in October 1979. It went to the relative top of the U.S. Billboard charts. It peaked at number 10. But it was a catchy song. It had a good acoustic background. It had some cool electronic elements. And it was a song that I remember, and here's where the nostalgia kicks in. I remember because it was associated in my mind with my cousins in California. I would go out to California. I'm an only child. I have three first cousins. Relatively small family. We'd go out to California in the summers, and in the late 70s, I traveled to California a number of times, one time for like a six-week stint, another time for like a two-week stint, and my cousins were all a little bit older than me, and they had more musically sophisticated tastes, better ears, more exposed to the wider world of music. I was a somewhat sheltered yeshiva boy, and they were more modern, to put it mildly. And this was a song I heard when I was visiting California. So between the sound of the song, the location, the smells of the neighborhood, this is the stuff of nostalgia. I think you'll know what I mean when you sometimes smell something and it evokes a memory that you had many, many years ago, even more than seeing something, because the senses have a way of drawing on our past, on our memories, on our deep recollections. When I got older, when I say older, in the past 10 to 20 years, this phrase of take the long way home started to be associated with a couple of biblical images. And the first of those biblical images is the very opening pasuk of Parshas Beshalach. It's a well-known verse because it follows quickly on the heels of the Exodus. It's really the first verse of the Jews in freedom after they leave Mitzrayim. And the pasuk reads, "Vayhi b'shalach paro es ha'am, v'lo nacham Elokim derech eretz plishtim, ki karov hu, ki amar Elokim pen yinachem ha'am Mitzrayma, pen yinachem ha'am bir osam milchama v'shavu Mitzrayma." Thank you. Good balkore here in the back. So this pasuk, just in terms of a simple translation, it's that when Paro let the nation free, they did not travel, God did not let them travel the way of the land of Plishtim, ki karov hu, because it was close. And there are some very interesting commentaries on what that closeness, is it a geographical claim? Is it a cultural claim? I'm going to use it for the geographical resonance. It was close, and so God did not take the close route because Hashem was afraid lest the nation fear the war and they would return to Egypt. And so instead, what does Hashem do? He takes the long way home. He leads the Jewish people through the Midbar. Even if it weren't for Chet HaMeraglim and the additional 39 years in the desert, it would have been a circuitous route back to Canaan. So this, for me, was an image of take the long way home. Tonight, I want to share with you an idea that forms, I think, one of the fundamental themes in the entire book of Bereishis. And it also, in my view, exemplifies a kind of theological take the long way home. And this really is I think, the motif or the theme that really runs through the entire book, the entire Sefer Bereishis. And it really becomes clarified, or it comes into bold relief when we look at the very end of the book of Bereishis, when we look at Parshas Vayichi. And so, I want to paint this picture for you tonight of another instance of taking the long way home. And it centers on the passing of Yaakov Avinu. Because, of course, Parshas Vayichi, while chronicling, narrating the passing of Yaakov Avinu and the end of the era of the patriarchs, has an ironic, counterintuitive beginning to it, right? It begins with the words "Vayichi Yaakov be'eretz Mitzrayim shva asrei shana," that Yaakov lives in the land of Egypt for 17 years. If you were to look at the Zohar's comment, the Zohar actually just magnifies or highlights the kind of counterintuitive claim that the pasuk is making here. This parsha really is about what? The death of Yaakov. It's really about the death of Yaakov. I mean, the whole thrust of the parsha, the build-up, and yet we begin, and the beginning is not just a literary device, but it sets a certain theological and thematic focus. It's the life of Yaakov. And what does the Zohar do with this? The Zohar actually says that the last 17 years of Yaakov's life, the 17 years he spent in Mitzrayim, were the most peaceful and tranquil in Yaakov's entire life. And not only that, but the Shekhinah, the divine presence that had departed from Yaakov with the death of Yosef in Canaan, returns to Yaakov Avinu in Mitzrayim for the remainder of his life, for those last 17, those glorious twilight years of Yaakov's life in Mitzrayim. And that gives him the ability to make the blessings, to offer these blessings, which are not just blessings, but they're also predictions. They're insightful character studies and predictions of the nature of the tribes, how their behavior, how their character will play out in history, in salvational history. So these last 17 years of Yaakov are years of great tranquility, great peace of mind. And it's both ironic and poignant that Yaakov finds this tranquility, which he had been searching for his entire life. How do we know that Yaakov was searching for this tranquility and peace his entire life?
Rashi
on what pasuk? Back at the beginning of Parshas Vayeshev, right? Vayeshev Yaakov, Bikesh Leishev B'Sheket U'B'Shalva. That Yaakov wanted to live in peace and tranquility. Kavatz Alav Rogzo Shel Yosef. Immediately, when he desires to live in peace and tranquility, the entire episode of Yosef comes about and obviously undermines that great quest for peace and tranquility. And so it is ironic that Yosef, who was the agent of his depression, the agent of his turmoil, becomes the agent of his tranquility in the place that he so feared, in the place that Yaakov Avinu so feared of actually going down to, making that exile. So the irony that Yaakov finally finds contentment in Eretz Mitzrayim should not be lost upon us. Now, if that weren't enough, in other words, if Yaakov's ascendancy, if you will, or Yaakov's spiritual renaissance, if that were not enough, the fact that it takes place in Mitzrayim, let's look at the actual death of Yaakov for another proof text or another source that shows how Yaakov has become a kind of model or exemplar, not only for his own children, but for the Egyptians, for his hosts. Right? What happens? What do we know about the death of Yaakov and the burial of Yaakov that drives this point home? Who buries Yaakov? B'nai Yisrael, obviously Yosef and the brothers, but who else? Right, look at, turn to page 2, the second side of your first page. Perek Nun, Psukim Zayin to Yud Aleph, Vayal Yosef Likbar es Aviv, Vayalu Ito Ko Avde Paro, all the servants of Paro, Ziknei Beso, all the elders, V'cho Ziknei Eretz Mitzrayim, and all the elders, the wise men of Egypt. So it looks like there was a mass exodus, a reverse exodus, if you will, but not of the Jews, but of Yaakov with the Egyptians. And they go and they bury him, right? And not only do we see that Yaakov can't escape his newfound identity and his life of tranquility in this foreign land, but even his burial and his death becomes a state funeral. It becomes the occasion of a state funeral. And not only that, it's not just a state funeral. What else happens? Look at the last pasuk there, Yud Aleph. V'yar Yosef ha'aretz ha'knani es ha'evil b'goron ha'atad v'yomru evil kaved zeh l'mitzrayim al'kein kara shma avel mitzrayim asher be'ever ha'yarden. What does that, how does that even deepen the dynamic of Yaakov's role in the culture of Mitzrayim, and the culture of the Near East, even broader than Mitzrayim? What's even a place name, even the name of this town becomes forever associated with Yaakov, this little Canaanite outpost that the Egyptians go to bury Yaakov becomes forever enmeshed with Yaakov Avinu. So we're playing around here with a kind of fluidity between exile, homeland. After all, he's back in Canaan. He's on his way to the Ma'arat HaMachpelah, his ultimate destination. But on the way in Canaan, there's this state funeral and this great fanfare around Yaakov. And it even affects not just the community of Egyptians, but the history of Egypt. The place names of Egypt and the surrounding, you know, region, Canaan. So the conclusion, at least of this little introductory section, is that Yaakov becomes a father figure not only to Bnei Yisrael, but Yaakov becomes a father figure to Canaan and Mitzrayim, to the entire region, to his ostensible, if I did not enemies, but certainly foreigners. And yet, Yaakov's perpetual dream and his constant yearning is for the land of Israel. Because if you look at the actual brachot that he gave, and we're not going to go through each of the brachot, but almost to a T, if you look at the brachot, especially if you look at them through the lenses of Rashi and Ramban and Radak, the classical Meforshim, you will see almost to a T that each of the blessings are meant as a blessing to take place in the land of Israel. That this one travels to the shores, this one has, you know, beautiful mountains, this one has certain, you know, properties. It's all forward-looking towards specifically the land of Israel. So the picture that I'm trying to paint right now, to just again to set the stage, to set up this long way home motif, is Yaakov's dual identity as father figure to Bnei Israel, of course, but also father figure to peoples and nations outside of his own people. People and nations outside of his own inner circle. Yes, Howie.
Does the Torah give us any... this may be a dumb question. Does the Torah give us any examples of why Egypt, the Egyptians fell in love with him? Or, I mean, he basically lived in Goshen and had a peaceful
Look,
life.
The Torah doesn't say explicitly, but the Torah through Yosef, in other words, Yosef is this great figure of wisdom and leadership. Yaakov, as the father of Yosef, and someone that Yosef himself venerates, is going to be given, I mean, that would just be on the pshat level. You know, the idea that the Shekhinah returns, that there's somehow a spiritual renaissance in Yaakov's life in the last 17 years, does that deepen the allure and the mystique around Yaakov? Probably. But at the very least, it's a sign of respect for Yosef, who clearly occupies, you know, this leadership role. But I want to lay it, you know, sort of take us one generation back before we go even further back.
Well, just a quick answer. I mean, Yaakov gave Rachel in the Nile, and it was that he stopped the Rachel. Yaakov gave him Rachel the life of Tarsha, that the Nile started flooding. So it's not surprising that Egypt.
He gives blessings to Paro.
Right.
And, you know, those blessings seem to come to pass. So he's a venerated figure. So that's one, if you want to call it an irony or a kind of counterintuitive theme, let's keep that with us. But let's dig a little deeper. Let's look at specifically the blessings. Who really, out of all the children of Yisrael, who does the best, so to speak? If you wanted to be very concrete and very numerical and we're very quantitative, who does the best out of all the brothers? Yosef.
Yosef has two sons above
Ephraim. Exactly. Yosef has two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And look at here on the bottom of page 2. Dibur Amas Rashi on Bereishis Memches Hey, which we'll just read quickly. Vatashnei Vanecha. This is Yaakov speaking. And now your two children Hanoladim Lecha Be'eretz Mitzrayim Ad Bo'i Elecha Mitzrayimah. Hold that thought, because we'll come back to Ad Bo'i Elecha Mitzrayimah. I think that's a critical key phrase. Liheim, they are to me. They are like to me. We're going to see what Rashi says. Ephraim and Manasseh Keruvein Shimon Yuli. They are like Reuven and Shimon to me. They occupy a special status in all the blessings because you, Yosef, produce two children. These two children will what? Look at Rashi on page 2 at the bottom. Liheim, b'chezbon shar b'naihem. They are included in my other sons. Litol chelek be'eretz ish kenegdo. They will get two. Each one will get their own portion. Ephraim and Manasseh will both get their own individual portion, which will make Yosef the recipient of a double blessing, of a pishnayim. That's the bechor. Remember, Yosef's only the bechor from Rachel. He's not the bechor of all the shvatim, but he gets the pishnayim in halachic terms. And yet, there's something really ironic and very puzzling about the choice of Ephraim and Manasseh to receive this pishnayim, or for Yosef to receive this pishnayim. What are the problems? Okay, let's see. Now we've set up this dynamic of Yaakov, Canaan, Mitzrayim. Let's now, if all the brachot are meant to be directed toward the life of Canaan, the ultimate return to Eretz Yisrael, to Eretz Canaan, why is Ephraim and Manasseh, why are they a strange choice to receive the Pishnayim? Okay, they are distinctly not of Eretz Canaan vintage. They are the only two of these tribes, of these children, that were not raised, born, and bred in Eretz Yisrael. They grew up in Mitzrayim. Furthermore, what's this interesting phrase that Yaakov uses? Ad bo yelecha Mitzrayima. What does that mean? Pasuk Hey. In Perek Memches, on the first page, I have the whole narrative there for you. But why does that phrase deepen our question? A, number one, Ephraim and Manasseh born in Mitzrayim, not born in Canaan, not born in Eretz Yisrael, not raised in Eretz Yisrael. But to dig a little further or a little deeper,
Yosef's other son, we're not part of it.
Okay, maybe, but let's focus on Ephraim and Manasseh for now. What is the Ad Bo'i? What does Ad Bo'i Elecha Mitzrayim mean? Let's just look at it from simple pshat. What does that phrase mean? Yaakov is the speaker. Ad Bo'i Elecha Mitzrayim. What does that mean?
Till I came,
meaning what? They were born when?
Before
Yaakov arrives in Egypt. So the influence of Yaakov on Ephraim and Manasseh is minuscule. It's not only that they were born in Mitzrayim and not in Canaan, but they were born before I arrived, before I had influence, before my heritage could affect their education. That deepens the question even further. Why are Ephraim and Manasseh the recipients of this great dual blessing? One more step. What are the names of Ephraim and Manasseh? What are the names of Ephraim and Manasseh? What is Ephraim? Ki? What is it? To prove or prove that he multiplied, that Yosef multiplied in the foreign land. What does Manasseh mean? He forgot. He forgot. He basically was able to forget his home. Yosef is saying, he's naming his child that Kineshani, I was able to forget Beis Avi. Both of these names highlight the disparity between Yaakov and Manasseh and Ephraim. They don't highlight any kind of congruity or any kind of deepening of the relationship. They highlight the exact opposite. Ephraim and Manasseh simply underscore how distant these two children are from Yaakov Avinu. Their names reflect that distance. What's the blessing to Ephraim and Manasseh? You could look inside if you want to find the actual source. But what's the blessing? What's the actual bracha to Ephraim and Manasseh? You guys all know this bracha, right? Because we say it every Friday night when you give your children the bracha. What's the bracha?
Simcha
Elokim Ephraim and Manasseh. And what? Bikar behem shmi b'shem avosai v'yidgu l'rov b'kerev ha'aretz. What does that mean? It's a nice bracha. V'yidgu l'rov b'kerev ha'aretz. What does that mean? You should multiply. Beautiful. How do you compare this bracha to the rest of the brachas in Parshas Vayichi? I mean, I'll just read them just very quickly. Don yadin amo ka'achat shifte Yisrael yihi don nachash alei derech shififo and alei horach hanoshech ikveso vipol rochvo achor. Exactly. They're personal, they're unique, they're distinctive. Zvulun lechof yamim yishkon v'hu lechof ein aniyot v'yarkaso al tzidon. Yitzchak Hamor Garem Rovetz Ben Hamishpatayim. V'yarmenucha ki tov ez ha'aretz ki na'ayma v'yet shichmo lisbol v'hilamas obed. Each of the brachos in Parshas Vayechi to the brothers are very personal. They're very rich in language and imagery. They're very distinctive to who these people are. They're not generic. Oh, have a lot of children. Multiply. Be fruitful and multiply.
He said he didn't know them.
Okay, so he doesn't know them, right? So it's hard to give a more individualized or more personalized bracha. And yet, so much of the time spent in Vayechi is building up to this bracha. There are a lot of other brachas, but this is the beginning of the whole bracha, of the whole narrative of the brachas, to Ephraim and Menashe. So the problem of generic, the generic nature of this bracha, is also part of the puzzle here. What else? Very interesting Rashi. Look at the Rashi here on page 3, at the top of page 3. This is Rashi commenting on when Yosef brings the boys in front of him, right? What does Yaakov first do? He says what? Mi'ela. Who are these people? Now look at what Rashi says. Rashi says something radical. Rashi on the top of page 3, V'yomer mi'ela, me'heichan yotzu elu. From where did these two children come from? She'einan ru'uyin levracha. That they're not worthy of blessing. That's an incredible statement. That Ephraim and Menashe, who are the ones who kick off the entire narrative of the brachot, who are the only ones who are the recipients of the Pishnaim through Yosef, they were not even worthy. And I didn't quote these sources, but there's an amazing Medrash Tehillim that says that Ephraim and Menashe were the captains of war of the Egyptian state. The whole Egyptian, you know, throne, the Egyptian political machinery, Ephraim and Menashe were at the head of that. They were leaders of the royal military force, which was a major, even today, Ad Yom Hazeh in the Middle East, the military is one of the pillars of the state authority. And this was Ephraim and Menashe. Now you understand maybe where Rashi gets that from. But otherwise, it's a very strange thing. So, how are we going to go about responding to these questions? In other words, how are we going to try to understand what is the nature of this bracha to Ephraim and Menashe? And I think, to begin, we have to acknowledge some nostalgia. And that's how we began this learning together, nostalgia. This bracha, which sounds generic, being fruitful and multiply, increasing the numbers, again, which is another, you could add it to the list if you wanted. The number, why is quantity more important than quality here? Why is the size of the nation more significant than what is the quality of the nation? What is the quality of the personalities that are forming this nation? But once I begin to frame this as a question of the bracha, the history of the bracha, there should be bells going off that tell you that there is a history to this bracha. And that if we want to understand Yaakov's blessing at the end of his life, in this time of great spiritual renaissance, we have to go back in history to earlier portions of Bereishis to understand the natural history of this very bracha. And so let's start to do that. Okay, let's look on page 3. So where do we actually find the hints, the kernel of this bracha that Yaakov gives to Ephraim and Menashe earlier in our history, earlier in the book of Bereishis? Okay, we'll get to Abraham, right? That is the start of the whole chain of blessing. But going back a little bit in Yaakov's history, right? Vayera Elokim El Yaakov O Bevo Mi Padan Aram. Yaakov is coming back from where? From exile, from the house of Lavan. And he blesses him. And what's the nature of the blessing? Look at Pasuk Yud-Av. V'yomer lo Elokim ani kel Shaddai, prey urvei goy ukahal goyim yeh mimeka, umelachim mechalatzecha yetzeyu. Very similar. It's a bracha that God, the God of strength, of power, should make you increase, and you should be a nation amongst nations, and from you kings, from your loins kings will emerge. Yes, Shari.
He also says it to, Yaakov says it to Yosef.
Okay.
Before he gives it to him.
Good. So there's an appropriation of this model, this bracha of increasing the numbers, the simplicity of reproduction, growth. There is a history of this bracha.
And that was also the part of the bracha that you skipped over about the Ha'olzi, which, you know, the, I guess, myself and some of them that you rescued from, you know, from a foreign land.
So the interplay between a foreign land and you're multiplying and your growth as a nation, that is somehow intertwined with each other. And what I want to do is actually suggest that that's the very key of this blessing. The interconnectedness of galut and return. The interconnectedness of growth and demise. These are all intertwined themes that really culminate in this bracha. And taking the long way home is actually the most apt metaphor for this entire journey in Brachos, which is a pointer to the future too. And let's develop this a little further. And let's just to reframe, you know, as Simcha just said, Yisimcha Elokim Ke'efraim Ucha Menashe, this is the blessing that Ad Hayom Hazeh, until this very day, we give this blessing to our own children. Even though the blessing seems to be so generic and so, you know, universal without the richness of the particular blessings to the other tribes, this is the blessing that we give. And so this bracha is unique, and it's also uniquely fundamental in Jewish thought. And if I wanted to formulate the question now to kind of to just name the question that we're in the midst of answering, why is such a special bracha given specifically to those that grow up outside of Eretz Yisrael? In other words, why is this bracha uniquely destined for Ephraim and Menashe? And they're also specifically given to those who separated from the influence of Father Yaakov, that Ad Bo'i Elecha. Shari?
And if your supposition is that even the place where he's buried is called after Mitzrayim, it seems that Mitzrayim had an impact on Yaakov. You could argue that the sons had that impact on Yaakov as opposed to Yaakov having an impact on them.
You mean the sons having the impact?
Yosef.
The sons of Yosef, right.
The three sons.
Okay.
Actually, it's sort of reverse,
right.
Reverse impact.
It's a kind of symbiotic relationship where each is giving of the next. And I think that's actually what I want to suggest, but we need one more piece of the puzzle here. We need one more part of the claim. And I think if we wanted to go back even further before Avram, you're right, in the next source, Brachos Chaf Ches, right? Yitzchak gives the same bracha to Yaakov, right? Yikra Yitzchak El Yaakov. This is before he leaves. Kum Leich Padena Aram, right? Before you go, you're going to leave to Padena Aram, Beis HaBesuel, your kinsman, and you're going to take a wife, and that's the key, as always. It's going to revolve around Rachel. Rachel is going to be the linchpin for this entire narrative and this entire puzzle. Ve'kel shakai yivarechoscha v'yafrecha v'yarbecha v'yisrael l'kal amim. The same blessing. The power, the Almighty God will bless you, will make you many, and you will become a nation amongst the other nations. I want to suggest that the key to this whole bracha that we've been discussing is really found in another mystery. And it's the mystery of Rachel. What do I mean? Let's look back to the first page, to the narrative of the bracha. So, Yaakov lives Be'eretz Yisraim. He knows he's going to die. He says, he brings Yosef and says, please swear to me, Yosef, that you will do for me a chesed ve'emes, al na kikbereini b'mitzrayim. Yosef agrees. After this, Yosef comes, and his father is sick, and he brings his boys, Ephraim and Menashe. He tells Yaakov that these are my children, and Yisrael, Yaakov, raises himself, strengthens himself on the bed, and wants to give him the bracha. They're going through the discussion of what the bracha is. We are, Kel Shakai Nira Eloi Beluz, Be'eretz Kanan, Ve'eretz Yisrael. God bless me at Luz, before I went into the Golus, and you're that's what you were referring to, that right before he gives this over to Yosef. And then there's a kind of like an ellipsis here, or a bracket. What does he say? Va'ani on Pasuk Zayin, va'ani bevoi mi padan mesa alai Rachel, be'eretz Kanaan b'derech be'od kivat eretz lavo efrasa ve'ekbara sham b'derech efras hi beis lachem. Okay. Why is this relevant? Why is this little appendix, if you will, or this little addendum about Rachel's death? It was on the way to Ephraim, to Beis Lachem, we buried her there. What's it doing there? So, most commentators, including Rashi, say what? What do you think? What does Rashi say? Here, Rashi says it, I have the Rashi for you on the bottom of page 3, Ekbara Sham. So Rashi says, and I didn't bring her even to Beis Lechem to go into the land. We buried her on the way to Beis Lechem, but it didn't quite reach Beis Lechem. The Yadati Sheyesh Belibcha Alai. What is Rashi getting at here? Why was Yaakov saying this? What is Yaakov asking Yosef to do to him right now?
To bury him.
Yaakov is requesting. Yaakov is requesting from Yosef, the firstborn of Rachel, to please bury me back in Eretz Canaan in the Marat HaMachpelah, in the cave that I did not bury Rachel in. So most commentators see this as Yaakov is trying to explain, to defend himself, because Yosef is already thinking, that's what Rashi says, that Yosef is thinking, V'yadati sheyesh b'libcha, I have a taina. In Yosef's heart, there's a kind of claim on Yaakov. You're asking me to bury you in Marat HaMechpelah when you didn't even bury my... Not only did you not bury my mother in the Marat HaMechpelah, you couldn't even come all the way to Beit Lechem. You buried her on the road. And Yaakov is explaining why it happened. Okay, but if that were true, when should this be appropriate? When should this line be appropriate for Yaakov to give his defense? When he's first asking about the burial. Why is he waiting in the middle of this bracha to Ephraim and Manasseh? He's about to give the bracha to Ephraim and Manasseh. And Yaakov says, wait, I want to tell you about what happened to Rachel. It doesn't make sense. It makes sense. Because the whole key to this bracha is what is the status of Rachel. And for that, you know the very famous pasuk in Yirmiyahu. We recite it. Kol barama nishma nehi b'chi tamrurim Rachel mevaka al baneha me'ana l'nachem al baneha ki einenu. Rachel represents the galut, represents all that will happen to the Jewish people outside of the land of Israel. Rachel becomes a symbol for all the suffering that will happen outside of the land of Israel, but that's a necessary part of the return to Israel. And that's the most beautiful imagery of the Al Haderech. The Al Haderech is not just a geographic placeholder or place name, it is a metaphor for the entire notion of Jews living outside of the land of Israel. Necessary, it's not just some unfortunate, tragic interlude in our history, it's necessary for our destiny, for getting back to Israel, but it's a necessary station on the way. And going through the experience of Galus, with all the learning that happens in Galus, with all the technology, with all the wisdom, these are all necessary ingredients of the Galus experience that eventually will be eclipsed by the return to Israel. And that's what Rachel represents. Look at the Ramban, it's a beautiful Ramban here. It's future-oriented. There was no road to Ephrat when Rachel was buried. That's anachronistic. It's all pointing to some future. In the future there will be, when there's a Davidic monarchy, when there's Beis David, there's Yehuda, there's Ephraim, there's Binyamin, then there'll be a Beis Lechem, a Kever Rachel. But it's marked for the future. It's on the road. Look at the Ramban says, Mesa lai Rachel b'derech ekbara sham b'derech. Klomer b'derech asher ya'avru ba b'neha Mesa. In the way that her children would go out outside of the land of Israel, that's where she died. It'll be for their benefit. He lo mesa, she doesn't die. Rachel Imenu doesn't die. The image of Rachel crying for over her children and hoping and praying for her children remains. Bederech rak b'ramash he ir ba'eret binyamin v'sham nikbara ava bederech shel atid meta. It was a future oriented on the way. And then finally, you mentioned that original bracha to Avram. Right, built into the bracha to Avram, the very first bracha for Aretz is what? What is built into the very fabric of the bracha to Avram by the Bris Ben Abasarim? Exactly, Egypt. Going down to Egypt. Not only Egypt, but what more even? Vayhi Hashemesh Lavo V'Tardayma Naflo, we're on page 5. Al Avram Hine Ema Chashecha Gedola Nofelas Alav. Very famously, Chazal, the Zohar, say that these languages of darkness, the deep slumber, the sleep, they are the four exiles. Pras, Bavel, Pras, Madai, and Yavan. That this built into the very blessing of land is the necessary ingredient of exile, of going out. Look at what Rashi says, V'hine Ema, Remez Letzaros V'choshech Shel Galyos. That the aim of the darkness is simply a hint, a foretaste of all the pain and suffering, the necessary pain and suffering. That's the Chiddush. It's not just pain and suffering. It's necessary. It's taking the long way home. That's exactly the point. We take the long way home through Golos, through those Tzaros, through the Choshech. Because Rachel becomes a magical source of inspiration. Yaakov, the next person, V'yavod Yaakov v'Rachel Sheva Shanim. He worked for her for 7 years. V'yihyu ba'inav ki yamim achadim ba'avaso osa. It was like just a few days. Yaakov loved Rachel so much that the 7 years passed as if it were just a few days. That's a perfect image for our love of Israel. We want to go back to our land. We want to go back to our peoplehood, to our sovereignty. And we pray for it. If we have that sense of wonder, that sense of love, that sense of magic that Rachel had, we could be, that's the talisman that Yaakov needs. Rachel is the talisman that Yaakov needs for this hope of coming back, even though it's taking them a long way home. I'll conclude with this beautiful Zohar. We're not going to read it inside, but basically the Zohar says on the pasuk, V'mesa alai Rachel, which we're saying is the linchpin of this whole narrative of taking the long way home, that there were many who died. Rachel is a symbol of those who died outside of the land of Israel. V'tigach krava am amamin, there'll be wars with other nations. V'musun menhon, we'll die from them. We'll die, we'll suffer, we'll die in battle. But ultimately, they're destined to live again, to achieve there, along that whole road, back, the Derech Efrasa, that we can live even better than we lived before. And that is our job in the Gullus, as we still remain in Gullus, to take those nitzotzot, take those sparks of holiness that are designed in the world of Gullus, and bring it back with us to learn how to be a nation, how to be a sovereign nation, ultimately back in the land of Eretz Yisrael. But we have to take the long way home first. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next week is Rabbi...